Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
Time to talk some football with the professor, John Clayton, as we do every day at this time. If you guys have football questions for the professor, you can text them in right now to 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Hello, John.
Hello, guys.
Well, I'm sure you heard that little stinger there and you talked about it. The cancellation of the Hall of Fame game, is this an ominous sign? Does it tell you that, all right, maybe the season's not going to start on time? What are you feeling from this cancellation? Because training camps, according to the league, still scheduled to start on time.
Yeah, it doesn't change anything. In fact, it was there's so many predictable things that you can just sit back, and I know I've been doing this now since May, maybe April or something like that. You know, once we really got into this pandemic, and so it's like, well, I bet you there's not going to be any OTAs. Bet you there's not going to be any mini camps. You know, bet you that everybody's going to stay virtual until July. Bet you that camps are going to stay on time, and I bet you that they shorten the preseason. And I bet you that they cancel the Hall of Fame game. And so, read very little into this on the Hall of Fame game. Because remember, they're only going to have two preseason games at the most, if they approve that. And that's going to be at the most. And so my guess is they wipe out the first week, the fourth week, and do it that way. It doesn't mean anything as far as the start of the season. I mean, everything is still a go. The only thing that needs to be approved by the players is to have like a quarterback rookie camp 7 days before the start of training camp. So, like, for example, the Seahawks are one of 26 teams that would go in on the 28th of July. And, if they approve this, the players, then you can have Russell Wilson or quarterbacks and rookies having a little bit of work. They'll kind of gradually get into things, just do some things there to kind of catch up. But if the players say no, then everything starts on the 28th, except for, you got Kansas City and Houston starting July 25th. And then you got four Monday night teams that are playing, and that's starts on the 29th. It's all 47 days before the opener.
Hey, John, also they're talking about maybe expanding practice squads from 12 to 16. That makes some sense, too, because, if you get some players that get knocked out by the virus, what are some of the changes as far as roster, game day, all that stuff that you've heard from the NFL?
Yeah, and again, to get on the practice squad, you still have to be cut. You figure that, but you need to pool of players available. And so what's going to be interesting about this, and this is one that you're not going to like, guess who's going to be a big part of those practice squads? Kickers and punters. And the reason I say kickers, punters, and long snappers, and the reason I say that is because, what if your kicker gets the virus for 2 weeks and now is not going to be available? So you want somebody that you can call up, not at a roster expense or anything like that, to be able to replace him. Now, the formula for that, still not known. You do know there's going to be 55, not 53 players on the field, or at least available on that Sunday. And so that's going to be part of the equation. But, yeah, I think that you basically want to try to back up every position, because if one, two guys go down at certain spots, you want to have bodies available to be able to fill in.
John, Malcolm Jenkins today on CNN, he's got a new role as a contributor for the network. He's also a New Orleans Saints safety. He says football is a non-essential business and that the risk needs to be eliminated before I'd feel comfortable with going back. Do you think we're going to see more players coming out like this?
You'll have a few. I don't think there's going to be a lot. I mean, I would contend there's probably going to be a few more in the NBA, even though the numbers aren't there. But, you're going to have people that are going to be reluctant to do it, particularly older players and that. And, Malcolm's an older player, and he's a good spokesman for players and for everybody else. But, it's nice to say, but, I mean, hey, these are football players. They want to play football, and they know it's going to be difficult. You know there's going to be positive tests. You know there's going to be problems. But in the end, 99.3% of them are going to be ready and eager to go. I mean, take a look what's going on in Tampa Bay with that bad situation with Tom Brady. They had the 17 players with the 49ers that practiced in Nashville for a week or so. two of them break bones and are going to be out significant time. You had one player on the 49ers get the virus. Now 16 others are quarantined. But that's just going to happen. But Tom Brady, you know, taking his dozen players every day, when the Players Association said, don't do it, don't have any group practices, he's out there with group practices risking his teammates.
What did you think of his Instagram post, picture of him taking a swig off the water bottle and then the quote of, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, sort of spitting in the face, if you will, of anybody that might be concerned about the virus?
I think it's selfish. I really do. I mean, you know, Russell Wilson was working with DK Metcalf. You got Detroit line players. You're going to have your pocket of players out there, but not at this time and not in that state. I mean, listen, you know, there's like 20% positive tests coming out of Florida, 26 and 27% out of Miami. And it's like here's in Tampa Bay. And right now, the new epicenter of the virus, and he's out there, you know, trying to, you know, get his 12 teammates up to speed on the offense, but at the expense of getting him sick. And it's not as if there haven't been any Tampa Bay Buccaneer players that had the virus. I mean, they have two players and one coach that has the virus. I just think it's selfish.
Are we getting any indication? I mean, I heard from Von Miller that he, you know, was short of breath for a while after that. But, you know, I guess with all of the privacy issues and everything, you're not going to get all details on, like, the Alabama players. And so, you know, when you have these cases come up, a lot of times, you know, and I've talked to a doctor friend of mine, he says, you know, the thing that's really thrown him for a loop is the asymptomatic people that they're testing positive. Mm-hmm. They don't even know they have it. But I mean, are we because they don't have any symptoms whatsoever, but are we getting any kind of indication of, you know, how severe these cases are? Because they tend to be less severe for younger people, but there's always exceptions.
Well, it also depends on the younger people and what they're doing, because I mean, if you what you look at the positive test down in Florida, I mean, it's gone from the average age was 65 now down to 27 to 33. And that's just in, you know, 1 month. I mean, and that's remarkable. And, you know, you do have some people, because, again, it's not as if you're not going to get hospitalized in some of these cases. I know a story, I think this was in Dallas, of, I guess it was in Florida, 10 kids got together and, you know, started partying on down and all that stuff. And, you know, one got hospitalized and the others got real sick, too. So it varies. I mean, because now I don't think the strain is changing. It's just that, you know, you got a lot of millennials and young people right now that are defiant and stupid and, you know, risking themselves on other people. Because, again, with the mask, you know what the deal is. It's like, yeah, you may, you know, you have a better chance of protecting others than yourself wearing the mask. But if you're out there, you know, partying, eating, no 6 foot distancing and anything like that, you cause any problems. And, you know, I think that's probably one of the, you know, the differences right now with the more positive tests in colleges than you're seeing in the NFL. Because, again, you know, there's more players that we don't know that will test or have tested or have the virus or not. But in the colleges, I mean, you know, they've got it going on both ways. No social distancing, and then also probably out there, you know, having a party and stuff like that. Can't do it. I mean, this is such a bad time because this thing is spiking almost. It's going to be right now worse than when it started.
John, I was reading yesterday about Jamal Adams and how the major reason he wants to be traded from the Jets is Adam Gase does not get along with his coach, apparently, John. Do you see a trade happening at all, or is it like a 5% deal?
If there's going to be a trade, it's going to be like a Jadeveon Clowney trade, you know, because one thing is that and Dave can verify this, you know, knowing Joe Vitnak, if you challenge Adam Gase, he'll find a way to get you off the team. So it's not out of the question. But right now, he's too valuable to the team because he's the team's best player. And so now, you know, they're not going to offer him anything because right now they don't know what the cap's going to be. And, you know, he can hold out. It's not going to help him, but he can hold out. But the more he does this, because a lot of players haven't liked Adam Gase. And that's, you know, one of the reasons he's on the hottest seat, I think, in the NFL, because, you know, Osamili didn't like the way that he got medical treatment. I mean, you can see that Le'Veon Bell's not big in his corner because, you know, he had a horrible season and, you know, didn't. And really, you know, Adam got it to be known that he doesn't like to pay running backs that much. So, you know, I'd give it more than a 5% chance, but, you know, it's not anything that's going to happen until maybe the last week of training camp.
John from the 360, and again, you guys can text in your questions for the professor to 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Professor, is Pete Carroll a lock for First Ballot Hall of Fame? What more does he need to do?
Well, not now. No, he's not a lock to be First Ballot Hall of Fame. I mean, Bill Belichick is, but you know, remember, it's hard for coaches to currently get in. Now, one of the things that's going to happen, I think, next month, because I know I've been the one pitching it the most now since the passing of Will McDonough, because Will's the one that had me on it and I followed up, is that I think there's going to be a coaching category. And if that's going to be the case, then, you know, starting, well, this year, then, you know, we can vote on a coach. Now, remember, we got a couple coaches in, you know, with some things in that 100-year project that we did. You know, Bill Cowher made it in, and you know, so that all that. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we still got some catch-up to do. And the way it works in the NFL, you know, 5 years after you retire, you then get a chance to go in. That's because of Bill Parcells. It used to be, you know, no time, and then Parcells, you know, retired and then unretired and, you know, threw everybody off. And so it's like, okay, coaches have to wait 5 years. But if we get this coaching category passed, he'll be in the Hall of Fame. And same thing, I think, with Mike Holmgren.
Professor, speaking of that, I know you've been out there many times. Do you have, do you hang around for the Hall of Fame game? Have you ever?
No. Oh, yeah, I've done it maybe. Well, no, actually, hang around for the Hall of Fame game. No. I mean, I did it maybe one or two times because that was so valuable in going out and getting to other teams' training camps that weekend. But see, you don't have to hang around now because the game is Thursday and the ceremony is on Saturday. So now what I do, I go for the game and I don't hang around for the ceremony.
Oh, okay. And what about the ceremony? So that's the part I kind of felt bad for, you know, the guys that are going in. This year is being postponed, correct?
Yes.
To next year? Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know. It's just it's a bad deal for everybody, obviously. But for those guys, you know, it's probably going to – they're going to be lumped in with the next class, I guess. And, you know, probably going to have to be shorter speeches and probably be a lot longer day.
Yeah, well, think about what's going to happen because, you know, we've got, what is it, 10 from the 100 year that, you know, is probably going to be in that group next year because, you know, they haven't said anything about those 10 because that was supposed to be in September when they got theirs. And so they'll be pushed back to that first Saturday in August, you know, because the game is going to be August the 5th, and then, what, 3 days after that, so August the 8th, roughly, is 7th or 8th is when they'll have the ceremonies. But, yeah, you'll have the class of 2021. You'll have the class of 2020. You'll have the class that came from the 10 that we voted in for the 100-year. I mean, the speeches better be short.
Yeah, I guess, John. Hey, Matt Rhule, the new coach for the Carolina Panthers, says he might take a knee during the anthem this year. You think we'll see more coaches following suit there?
Yeah, but what I hope is that, you know, the coaches, Roger Goodell, you know, Melvin Jenkins, maybe even Colin Kaepernick, you know, they all put their heads together and see if there's not a better way to do it. Because now at least you know you got, you know, coaches, white coaches, you know, the league office, you know, they're now kind of unified and they want to do something together. But what happens if there's nobody in the stands? Okay, so if there's nobody in the stands and you kneel and they don't put it on TV, nobody's going to see it. So my idea, which of course may not be the right one, is to, you know, put together some videos that, you know, with Matt Rhule, you know, doing something with his team, like Teddy Bridgewater or whatever. But I think, you know, showing that unified effort and trying to do more than just a kneel. Because I think that, okay, you know, maybe there's still people confused. It's like, okay, what does a kneel mean? Well, explain it. Talk about it. And I think that, you know, I don't know if a video is enough. I think, you know, some show that everybody's together on this, that's enough. But I just think they can come up with a better way than just kneeling.
Hey, John, I saw this piece by Field Yates on ESPN. It was imagining five player trades that could help both teams. So he threw it out there. I want to get your take on two of them. One of them was Jacksonville trades Yannick Ngakoue to the Browns for tight end David Njoku in a 2021 second-round pick. And the other one involved our very own Seattle Seahawks. They trade Ethan Posick to the Philadelphia Eagles for cornerback Sidney Jones. What do you think of those two ideas?
I think trading Ethan Posick, that it's intriguing. But of course, I mean, he's the chance to be the center, and they've got enough cornerbacks. It's almost like the safety idea with Jamal Adams, and Jones has not been good. I mean, he came in hurt. He hasn't established much as a third cornerback and all that stuff. But it's like, okay, so now, who would you rather see, Sidney Jones, Trey Flowers, or Quentin Dunbar? And the question is, and the answer is, you're going to put Jones in the spot at the back. He's number four if you include Shaquille Griffin. So don't like that trade. The one trade, give me the first trade.
It was Yannick Ngakoue going to the Cleveland Browns for their tight end, David Njoku, in a 2021 second round pick.
Yeah, that's not bad because they don't have hardly anything at tight end for Gardner Minshew, but remember, it's like, okay, how much do you want to really pay at the defensive end position? They've got to do a $22+ million deal on Myles Garrett. Okay, they've got Olivier Vernon at $15.4 million. They gave Camille Correa $2.25 million, and they can get Clowney for almost much less than the $17.7 million that Ndokwe gets. So it's an intriguing thought. Gives them some value. And, they've got Hooper there, so they don't have to worry about tight end. There's some interest there, but, again, I think that's too much at the defensive end position.
John, you guys might have talked about this week. Somebody wanted to know about Brandon Mebane. What is his status? Somebody talked about possibly signing here. Did he retire?
He retired without the announcement. Yeah, because that was the reason they let him go, because they like him a lot, but they let him go because they anticipated he is going to retire. And so far, he's not done anything as far as showing that he does want to play. So, like, for example, I mean, he would be an ideal guy to consider for this team, but I think he's retired.
Okay. Professor, DeAndre Hopkins last year, 104 receptions, 1,165 yards, 7 touchdowns. What do you think his numbers will be with Arizona this year?
Probably a little bit higher. I mean, I'd say that 108, 110 catches. I think you'll have a good average and all that stuff. He's got a good quarterback that's going to get better, and Hopkins is going to make him look better. I was hoping that what you weren't saying is that he had 104 catches in that game against Seattle 2 years ago, because it was pretty close, because they had over 200 yards. But he is going to be a pain. All I know is that when the Texans traded him, there was a sigh of relief by the three defensive coaches and the defensive players in the AFC South. He drove them all crazy, and he's going to drive all the teams in the AFC and the NFC West crazy.
John, screen refresh, so I don't have the area code. But somebody texting in asking if Derek Carr is on the hot seat and what kind of slack does he have with Gruden.
Yeah, I think he's on the hot seat because it's like, if he wasn't on the hot seat, you're not going to spend 2 years, $17.6 million on Marcus Mariota. And what's put him on the hot seat is two things. One, he didn't get the ball downfield. I think he had a 6.2-yard average and that on per attempt, and that drives John Gruden crazy. And the other thing is, this is John Gruden, and this is Derek Carr, and Derek Carr doesn't like to hear curse words. It offends him religiously to hear curse words. Well, what do you get out of John Gruden? Curse words. So it's like the Gruden dog's always going to be cursing, and that doesn't go well, and I think it has strained the relationship. And it's like, Derek is not afraid to express, coach, I don't like hearing what you're saying. I don't like these curse words. And it's like, that's only going to get him to stew even more. So, yeah, I think he is on the hot seat.
Did you call him the Gruden dog?
The Gruden dog, yeah. I called him that for years, a Gruden dog.
I have never heard that.
The Gruden dog would always talk about him at ESPN.
Well, Derek Carr, look, I understand. I understand that there are people that don't like to hear obscenities and everything, but I don't know. It just seems to me like, you're the one that kind of has to make the change there. You're the one that kind of has to, be a little bit more accepting of it just because of the environment. Philip Rivers isn't that way, right? I mean, he doesn't cuss at all, but he doesn't.
No, it's not. He's offended by anybody that's cussing, but he doesn't cuss whatsoever. No.
Yeah. So I just.
It's a different thing.
That's
it's like
on Carr.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine him around like Terry Taylor or players like that that are going to be cursing all the time? It's like.
Yeah.
Could you imagine him around? I take it that Derek probably is not a big Samuel L. Jackson fan.
Well, you have to believe he's heard it through high school football, through college football, in the pros. I mean, it's not a new thing that he's dealing with. So why would he draw the line now?
I mean, it's not that he's done. It's not that he's changed. He's always been that way.
Well, there's been lots of players that have, you know, put up with that. I mean, Steve Largent and Jeff Kemp and Paul Scanzi. I mean, those guys never did. But, you know, it was, you know, and I tried to be respectful around them. But it wasn't like I was going to, you know, entirely shut it down. But so
no, anyway. I think you have to be I think you have to be bleeping and respectful without question.
Okay. All right. John, I like this question here. Somebody asked, what was it about football? This is the 206. What was it in your life that made you begin to love football so much?
My mother. You know, because my mother, nurse in the operating room in the VA in Pittsburgh, loved the Steelers and loved football. And so she would take me to the games starting when I was, 7 or 8 years old. And, we'd sit out in the bleachers and all that at Pitt Stadium. And, you know, she'd pay full price for the tickets for me when you could have got a discount. And all the neighbors and all that stuff, they were sitting there. It's like, why you have the bratty little kid here? All he's going to do is sit there and eat. And all I did was watch football with my mom. And so, out of respect for my mom, and I ended up telling this story at the Pro Football Hall of Fame when I got inducted, is that I thank my mom for that, because she got me into football, and we went for years and watched as many games as we could. And then she was so happy when I got in high school and started being able to cover it for a newspaper. So that was good. So, and then of course, at the end of the speech for the Hall of Fame, I said, hey, thanks, Mom, for paying for full price.
Nice.
That's a cool story, John. Do you think if you ever retire, like let's say you're 75 years old, do you think you'd go back to being a Steelers fan?
Well, to be honest, it was I go back so far, it was hard to be a fan. I guess maybe that's helped me be a reporter, because, I mean, that team was awful. I mean, you know how many bad things I say about the Cleveland Browns, but the Steelers were actually worse than the Cleveland Browns for the years. I mean, they had so many bad years, and it didn't change until 1969 when they brought in Chuck Knoll, and they drafted Joe Green, and the next year they got Terry Bradshaw, and then they built things up to a point where they became a Super Bowl dynasty. But by that time, I was covering. So I guess, I was there, watching. It was like, it's hard to cheer if your team doesn't do anything. And they only make mistakes and lose. So I guess that's why I was also fortunate in the sense that I was in a Steeler era that wasn't very good. Then I became a reporter, so I don't have to be a fan.
John, we appreciate it. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good.
Hey, if you missed any of today's Cold Hard Facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, download the podcast at 710sports.com. Well, baseball is going to be underway, and hoping the season will go off without a hitch in terms of the 60-game schedule. We'll talk to John Morosi of Fox Sports, Major League Baseball Network. He's going to join us next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Get a chance to talk some baseball with a man who can put a positive spin on anything. It just makes you feel better about life and baseball. You catch him on the MLB Network, Fox Sports. Our buddy John Morosi is with us. John, how are you, man?
Gentlemen, I'm doing well and optimistic that indeed pitchers and catchers re-report next week, although certainly it looks a lot different from when we last saw them.
Yeah, it's they didn't actually come to an agreement, so I guess we can worry about what that means later. People anticipating a work stoppage next year, animosity, bad feelings, all that good stuff. But for now, 60 games in 66 days. Who has the advantage in this? We've talked about the Mariners being such a young team. This whole year was going to be about, just getting the youth up to speed, sort of building the core, letting them get experience, versus a veteran team who's going to compete this year. In a shortened season like this, who has the advantage?
Well, I'll start by saying this. The best team, I believe, for 60 games is the same one that I thought was the best for 162, and that's the Dodgers. Their pitching rotation, when you consider how they're going to be able to piggyback their starters and relievers. In fact, Dave Roberts said this week on MLB Network Radio that his expectation is that the first time through that no starter will go beyond four innings. But that's not a problem for him because he's got Tony Gonsolin and Brewster Gratterall and Dustin May, some really, really high-end arms in the bullpen that they could really be piggyback starters. So they're so deep. They're a National League team that, of course, they've still got Jock Peterson there and A.J. Pollock. They can really mix and match. They've already got an American League-style lineup anyway. So I look at the Dodgers still as the team to beat, broadly speaking. But aside from that, there is some randomness here, and I think you could see some teams emerging from the middle part of the major leagues, maybe that didn't make the playoffs last year. I look at Arizona, the White Sox, the Reds. I think there are some teams that did a lot to improve themselves. The A's, of course, made the wild card game, but I think they're a much better team today than they were then. So I really look at it as there are probably those elite-level teams, the Dodgers maybe even above everybody else. But then after that, I think a lot of those playoff berths are up for grabs.
John Paul, how much do you think the labor disputes will affect ratings? I guess we don't really know what it was going to look like once they came back, whether they had labor disputes or not. But do you think people have soured a little bit, or do you think now that they have this deal done, everybody's going to openly embrace baseball again?
Well, Dave, I hope the answer is the latter. I hope that that we're able to just move forward and appreciate and be grateful for what we've got, just having baseball back on television sets and on the radio airwaves for us all. There may be some lingering negativity around the way the negotiations played out. Really, to me, it's a missed opportunity more than anything else, because had things proceeded at the pace the discussions could have been, we might right now be talking about the Mariners playing regular season baseball. It could have been this quick. Obviously, if the public health situation would allow it, but it's certainly plausible we could have seen next weekend, 4th of July weekend, baseball back. And that, to me, is a huge missed opportunity. I think we saw today Liverpool winning the EPL. So much excitement around the sports world. And that becomes an international, global story because a lot of leagues aren't going. And I think baseball, not just domestically, but internationally, well, we could have seen a real dramatic increase in interest in Major League Baseball around the world, because it would have been one of the handful of leagues going at this point in time. But, of course, now it will come back around the same time as everything else. So I don't look at it as much as a depression in interest. I look at it more as a missed opportunity for what could have been if the sides had come together a lot sooner.
Hey, John Paul, this isn't a bigger picture question. It's a really small question, but I'm looking forward to not having litter in the dugouts. I just am. Maybe I'm in the minority on that. But I also saw where players can't spit anymore, they can't use smokeless tobacco, and they can't have sunflower seeds either. Out of those three, John, which one do you think they're going to have the most difficulty with?
That's a great question, Jim. I haven't really thought about what you see most often. I would say that spitting writ large, because that sort of encapsulates the smokeless tobacco part of the conversation, that probably will be the greatest change. And we don't know. It's a very interesting question, and the answer is we don't know what punitive measures will be put in place. We do not know if the first person to spit on a baseball field will be ejected. I would assume the answer is no, but there is really no system of fines to be put in place. This is not football where you would have an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty for 5 yards in that circumstance, or 15, depending on how you view the severity of the offense. I mean, this is a very unique set of circumstances overall. Some rules about how soon people can arrive to the stadium, how quickly they must leave. There's a lot of aspects of the game that are going to change. And I really think, Jim, not to dodge the question beyond answering about the spitting, but I think we're going to see the teams that have really strong veteran leadership, players that get it, players that are going to have good habits at the ballpark and away from the ballpark, they're going to succeed, because I think to really have a positive team vibe in this environment, it's important, first and foremost, for health purposes, to make sure that you're getting your rest and keeping your social distancing, but also to keeping a positive outlook on things when so many things have changed.
John Paul, you're just the absolute best, because you know, any other guest might have said, man, that's a stupid question, and you called it an interesting question, so I appreciate that.
Well, it's the truth. I call them like I see them, my friend.
John, as far as crowds being allowed in and out, it feels like, you know, it'll be a state-by-state situation, but it feels like the Astros and the Red Sox catch a massive break this year, and maybe the Yankees, where they're not going to have to, you know, suffer through the ire of those in the stands the way they otherwise would. What do you think of that? And also, what can you tell us about the Yankees? It seemed like that story was bubbling for a couple of days. I saw that there were some Astros players that took shots on Twitter at Aaron Judge for things he had said about them stealing signs. What do we know about that Yankee story?
Well, regarding the Yankees, for now, the findings of that letter remain under seal, and we're not able to read them at this point in time from a public disclosure standpoint. So that I think you're right that it sort of perpetuates that mystery around it, and maybe the skepticism about what the Yankees have been doing during that era, during the last decade, the latter part of the last decade. It's really a great question. Difficult to really contemplate what was in the letter. There was at the time a finding that a bullpen phone had been, or the dugout phone rather, had been used inappropriately, but not really substantiated as to what exactly had happened there. Just that the rule had been violated in some way, but it wasn't clear exactly what the implication was. It does seem like there's an incomplete understanding there that something theoretically could have been going on that would be embarrassing to find out, but we don't know what it is. And that to me is difficult, that we do know chapter and verse what was going on with the Astros, but less so about the Yankees. Admittedly, the Astros situation happened after the overall policy of the league had been clarified, and we'll just have to see how history reviews whatever the Yankees are found to have done, if in fact we end up seeing the letter in due time. I think you're absolutely right about, especially the Astros, there had been so much ire against them, even more so than the Red Sox. The Red Sox did not really get a significant penalty. The Astros did. The Astros, though, to me, and of course you'll see them in the American League West, especially a lot given this unbalanced schedule that we're going to have, they are benefiting, I think, greatly from the fact that they've got a healthy Lance McCullers Jr., who, if you had the full season, might have been on an innings limit because of having Tommy John surgery. And then Justin Verlander, he had the issue, the groin hip issue in spring training, and now he appears to be fully healthy. I think as much as the narrative around the team was so toxic in spring training, I really think that Verlander and McCullers being able to go with them without restrictions is probably as important to them on the field as almost anything else.
John Paul, I know we're up against the break real quick. Maybe you can't answer this quickly, but or hopefully
I'll
I can
try.
Ask the question quickly. we were talking earlier about, you know, the reticence to bring guys up, you know, who are young and how different it is than football. Why is it, what is it about baseball, do you think, that, you know, they talk about you don't want to bring a guy up too early, you might ruin him mentally. Why is it so much like that in baseball as opposed to other sports? Because, you know, I'm a football guy and I feel like, hey, you go out, you get your butt kicked, you learn from it, but what would you say is the biggest difference there?
No, it's a really important question, and I'll answer it a couple ways. I think number one, the game is one of failure, and there is so much failure even at the major league level. It's very hard on you mentally from that standpoint, that I've had executives tell me that if they have not properly pushed their young players to the point of failure in the minor leagues, that they have not done a good job developing that player. So if a player just has tremendous years every single season, that is, in a sense, some people would tell you, a failed developmental path, because they're going to struggle eventually, and you do not want that to happen in front of 50,000 people every night at the major league level. And it's a very interesting insight. And so I think that just because of the failure, you want to make sure you're overly prepared. Also, I think the act of hitting, the different pitches that you see, especially now, it takes a lot of practice, a lot of repetition to do that. And I also think from a standpoint of, also on the pitching side, both developing the efficiency of your secondary pitches, most gifted pitchers were able to succeed with their fastball primarily at the younger levels. And so the curveball, changeup, slider, usually a little bit slower to develop. It's really key to make sure those pitches are all locked in at the Double-A level.
John, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much. As always, we look forward to talking to you again next week, and I can't wait till we're talking about action on the field. So thanks again.
Oh, it's going to be so great. I can't wait either, my friends. And I appreciate you guys always keep me in the loop during the course of this long wait. It's meant a lot to me, and look forward to the next conversation too.
Stay safe out there. There you go. There's John Morosi from Major League Baseball Network and Fox Sports. Does a great job covering the sport of baseball. Coming up, we find out more about what a net zero carbon arena means, and we hear about Jay Cutler's hunt for a chicken serial killer. That's right. That's on his farm. It's coming up next as we sweep the dial with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelter, Dave White, and Jim Moore. Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
Buildings like this were dependent upon gas, natural gas. Well, we're not going to have gas in this building.
We're going to be capturing rainwater from our roofs and using it to make the ice.
How can you not have a building that's committed to the climate pledge? How can our players not be skating on anything other than rainwater?
We got rid of all fossil fuel use. We've fully decarbonized. We've gotten rid of natural gas for everything in the arena. The electricity to make the ice is renewable. All the electricity is also being generated by off-site solar farms, so completely powered by renewable energy. Even the Zamboni's electric. We need to be not only zero energy, but we need to be zero waste.
We believe by 2024 we'll be a no plastics building. So we're not just going on the journey. Our fans are going to go with us. Our corporate partners are going to go with us.
So that's part of a video that the NHL Seattle released discussing Climate Pledge Arena. It's going to take a while to get used to that and what a net zero carbon certified arena means. And hey, I'm all for it. You know, for people complaining about it and saying it's I saw people on Twitter saying it's divisive, it's political. Come on. Nobody's asking you to do anything except go to the game, enjoy a beer, have a hot dog, watch your team, and go home. You don't have to take a pledge. You don't have to wear anything differently. You don't have to say anything differently. You just be a fan the way you would in any other building. So let's not turn it into something it's not.
Yeah, well, I guess the only thing I bristled at, the pledge part makes it sound like it's some sort of, you know, charitable thing or something for the environment. No, I mean, these things are working now and people are making money off of it. And that's where you have to go when you want to help the environment. It has to be economically incentivized. So I just read over the weekend there's a company down in Houston where they're capturing like 5,000 tons of carbon dioxide that normally would go into the atmosphere. And what they've done is turned it into generating power. It's the equivalent of taking like 350,000 cars off the road. And so this company was able to be started because they eased some restrictions and things like that. But it's not like it's a good old boy thing. It's they're making money and they're helping the environment at the same time. And so that kind of sounds like what's going on here. So, you know, I'm not on either side as far as the politics, but that's how you get, you know, those kinds of things done. Is, you know, I talked earlier about the Priuses and the electric cars. I mean, it used to be that, you know, old rich people bought them because they thought it was a good thing to do for the environment. But with Lyft and with, Uber and all that, you know, I mean, these electric cars, they're making businesses more viable. And actually, Greg's Japanese Auto, which is awesome company, they use Priuses to transport their parts between their different locations throughout the Puget Sound. And the reason why they do it is because it's economically viable. So I love it, man. I mean, I don't know what the pledge thing. I guess net zero was already taken. But, you know, to me, that it just makes a lot of sense. And I think it's really cool. And I think it's genuine. It's not like they're trying to do it because they want to, you know, look good to environmentalists or something like that. They're doing it because it's a win-win.
Well, yeah, they're saying, and it is different, though. I don't know whether I like it or don't like it. I'm just looking at it going, boy, Climate Pledge Arena, Climate Pledge Arena. I guess we'll get used to it. Like Bob was saying, you go from Safeco Field to T-Mobile Park, and so it'll become commonplace. We'll probably call it, hey, you going to go to Climate Pledge tonight, not have the arena? I don't know, but I'm perfectly fine with it. I think it's great what they're trying to do. Todd Lewicki talking about rainwater for the ice, no fossil fuels, electricity generated by solar farms. They're intending to not have any plastic products there by 2024. So I think it's a good thing overall.
Yeah, here's the first story. It's a big one. We've got a chicken serial killer on the loose. We've lost quite a few. Tonight we're going to set up a trail camera, see if it's a coyote, bobcat, I don't know, raccoon. Could be anything. Not sure. But that's enough. These ladies are a little edgy right now, so we've got to figure this out. There is one other possibility. Could be an inside job. Thelma over there, while she looks nice and sweet, is a savage with loose morals. Thelma, hey cat, kitty cat. I hope you don't show up on camera tonight.
That's Jay Cutler on Instagram. I didn't know he lived on a farm. Apparently, his chickens have been getting killed or something. So. He was showing a little video of chickens, and he was setting up a trap to catch the chicken serial killer, and his cat walks into the frame, and you heard him talk about, yeah, she looks cute, but she's a savage with loose morals. So, kind of funny seeing a sense of humor out of Jay Cutler that you didn't see on the NFL field anyway.
Now, Shannon has a cat named Nikki, who is this sweet little cat that has, like, bunny fur and has this polite little cute meow. That cat is a trained killer, and it brings things to the front doorstep all the time. And I hear this, I texted into 710-710 if you think this is true. My wife tells me she's a huge cat fan, that cats, yeah, they bring gifts to you, but that cats are the only animals that hunt for sport.
Huh. Didn't know that, Dave. Maybe the texters can enlighten us with that one.
Maybe they'll clear it up for us.
Yeah, I get a kick out of Cutler, though. Do you like him a little better now, Dave?
Yeah, I've always kind of liked him. I thought he was a punk. Ever since I owned his Smokin' Jay Cutler t-shirt, which I still have, and I don't think you can buy those anymore. Yeah, I've kind of liked Jay Cutler. He's kind of a lovable jerk, you know, or a punk kind of, you know. He's just kind of pops off a little bit. And remember when he was retired, his girlfriend asked him what he was going to do, and he says, I'm trying to not do anything.
He always looked like he didn't care.
He looked like he should have a cigarette in his mouth. That's why they call him Smoking Jay.
I'm not saying I'm unwilling to get on board. I'm saying that I'm uncomfortable being the guy who's hitting on the married individual at the bar. And that person is saying, I'm thinking about leaving my partner, and you're trying to encroach and put your best foot forward at a point before the actual separation has even happened. I'm uncomfortable. And this is a little bit about how I felt coming out of Seattle's pursuit of the Sacramento Kings. And it was an effort to acquire a team. And knowing that you're going to have to do to another city what was done to you, I'm not saying I'm unwilling to go down that route. I'm just saying I got qualms about it. Whatever qualms are, I've got those. I've got qualms.
Danny O'Neill talking about the Memphis Grizzlies, who reportedly have an opt-out in their lease if attendance numbers are not met, where they can move elsewhere. And Seattle's become the boogeyman in everybody's story. It was that way in Milwaukee. If the Bucks weren't going to get a new building, then, boy, Seattle sure looks like a good destination. And we saw how the Kings, you know, worked their thing. And I'm sure Seattle will be used as a boogeyman again. And even more so now that there's a new arena on the verge of being finished for 2021. Saying, well, look at that. They've got a brand new building that could house this team. What a perfect landing spot. They desperately want basketball. I don't take any of it seriously. If they're going to opt out and it's no turning back in their situation, then I'm on board. But I'm kind of with Danny, like openly courting a team that's still in another city and still may stay there feels a little hypocritical because of what happened here in Oklahoma City.
Well, was anybody really mad at Oklahoma City, or were they mad at
No, just Clay Bennett.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, that it's more on them. And I know, Jim, you probably have a different opinion on that. I don't know. But I guess I'm not as passionate about the Sonics as I know you were, Jim, and Danny, too, who covered him for a long time.
Yeah, I think Danny had a good observation there, having the little analogy about being in a bar and the married person being there and still in the marriage but getting out of it. No, I'm with Danny. I'm with Bob. I'm with you, too, Dave. I can't imagine that they could trigger that clause given what's happening this season. Well, of course they're not going to meet the attendance figures when there's no games. And if there were any game, and they're going to be playing in Orlando, so I don't know how that's all going to shake out, but I do remember when the Grizzlies moved to Memphis from Vancouver, and I don't know how people in Vancouver felt about it. They weren't there that long, but I never like seeing a team move from a city because you feel bad. I feel bad right now for Oakland Raider fans. I know everybody's excited. Boy, the Las Vegas Raiders, but think about all those Oakland Raider fans that are hating it. So, yeah, I just kind of want, at this point, we've waited long enough. We've got Climate Pledge Arena is going to be ready to go next year, and I'm sure soon after that there'll be an expansion team available. Rather than poaching another city's team, just wait for an expansion team.
All right, coming up, we'll talk some NFL with a man who was in the front office for the Green Bay Packers, and now he's an analyst. Andrew Brandt will join us next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.